Don't at me, but somehow Green Book the movie makes traveling in the Jim Crow South seem, I don't know, charming. Let's get into it right after the theme song. What's up, Donatters? The Farrelly brothers are two of the most iconic comedy filmmakers of all time. From Dumb and Dumber to Me, Myself, and Irene to There's Something About Mary, odds are you have seen a great deal of their work. One half of that duo, Peter Farrelly, has stepped out to create a film that's truly a departure from his comedy career. I'm, of course, talking about Green Book.
Yeah.
Some guy called over here, a doctor. He's looking for a driver. You interested?
I am not a medical doctor. I'm a musician. I'm about to embark on a concert tour in the Deep South. What other experience do you have?
Public relations.
Do you foresee any issues in working for a black man?
You and the Deep South? There's gonna be problems.
Today, I am joined by Peter Farrelly, director of Green Book, as well as the film's composer, who also happens to have created our theme song, Chris Bowers. Let's get into it. I'm really excited because I actually get to talk craft today and process with the minds behind the new film Green Book, which is a great movie. It's coming out this Thanksgiving. Green Book follows Dr. Shirley in the 1960s. He is a world-class pianist played by Mahershala Ali, and it follows the bond that he builds with his racially presumptuous driver, played by Viggo Mortensen, as he performs through the Jim Crow South. I thought it had some immaculate filmmaking, and I thought what was so powerful about it is that we're seeing these two guys, you know, this Italian-American, 1960s kind of machismo, East Coast kind of mentality, also being a fish out of water with this black man who really didn't have the experience of other black people in the country. He was sort of discovered as this virtuoso and kind of plucked out of everyday life. And the two of these very unlikely friends bond in probably the most racially divided part of the country. Where did the movie come from? That's always the question you got to start with.
What you just said, I wish they could do a trailer that captured that, because they haven't got one yet. That's that good. No, it's exactly right on the nose. Oh, I'm sorry, what was the question?
Oh, I don't remember. Where does it come from? You know,
where's the story come from?
Yeah, and I'll give you one more preface because, yeah. You know, black filmmaker, black audience goer, you know, surprise. But every year, I kind of roll my eyes because there's always that, like, awards movie about the Jim Crow South that's really about white people but pretends to kind of be somewhat about black people. And the black characters are sort of these undercooked, tragic but noble figures who are, you know, their one purpose for being in the movie is to show you how racism works. And then you walk out because the white person did something good and we all give it an Oscar and lots of money. And I kind of roll my eyes because we get this movie every year. Yeah. This is not that movie.
Thank you.
So I just got to hear more about its origin stories.
Yeah, it was, I bumped into a guy named Brian Hayes Curry, who's one of the writers, along with Nick Vallelonga and myself. And just probably 3 years ago, and he's an actor too. I said, what are you up to? He said, I'm writing a screenplay about my friend's father. It's a true story, happened in 1962, and described it sort of the way you did, not as well. And I thought, that's such a good story.
Now, I'm going to switch here because, you know, while, you know, I got Peter Farrelly here to talk about the directing and the show, you know, I got to look to my left at Mr. Chris Bowers, who is the film's composer. Did you know about, I have to assume that you knew about Don Shirley. I did not.
So. I actually didn't. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the first time I heard about him was reading the script. And I was pretty surprised, especially because I've never heard somebody combine jazz and classical music in the way that he did. There are a lot of other musicians from that era that did a similar thing and that were classically trained and tried to infuse their music with that, but he was incredibly unique. And so, yeah.
Yeah, his music is odd. I mean, in a great way. It sounds like, it's classical, it's jazz, it's also a little pop, but it just doesn't sound like anything I've heard before. It kind of lives in its own lane, and it's remarkable that this musical figure who, you know, really was a genius, no one really knows about him.
Yeah, and he was making music for a while, which is wild that, you know, it'd be different if he only had one album, but he has like a handful of albums. Yeah.
And people do know him. I meet people, older people, He wasn't known by everybody, but the cool cats knew him. Cool They're cats like, oh, are you kidding me? Don Shirley? Yeah, sure. I remember Don Shirley.
Like Duke Ellington knew him. Yeah. Right? They became friends, I think I've read somewhere, when they finally found each other. I mean, in a lot of ways, this movie is about finding your people.
Right.
And your tribe. And, but, you know, what's curious about it is that it's a black man who is not only, I won't say he's upper class, because he gets to the South and you see just how not upper class he is, but he certainly had an upper class sort of upbringing, you know, bougie is what we'd call it today. You
his parents were very successful. He did come from a well-to-do family in Pensacola, Florida, and so he was educated. What that education was is now very it's debatable, because he called himself a doctor, and we know he did get some doctorates, at least honorary, but it's hard to tell exactly what all the other stuff was. But he was extremely intelligent, spoke several languages.
Right.
We believe he had been educated in Russia, but again, that's debatable, though that's on all his album covers. You know, that his backstory was that he had studied there for 7 years, and we do know that he started, you know, he was like the youngest guy to play with the Boston Pops, and, you know, so it's still, you know, he was a real interesting guy.
There's different ways to do this. You could have shown us, and you being the royal you and the writers, the storytellers, you know, you could have given us the story from Don's perspective. You could have, there were different ends. Why was Tony Lip, played by Viggo Mortensen, Italian-American, you know, more of a, I guess, straight white perspective, although I would, the Italian-American perspective in the 60s is a little different than the typical American white perspective. Why do we meet Don from his point of view?
That's a great question, by the way, and something we debated when we were writing it. We thought about going the other way, but and you know, having Tony Lip come to him, but we had the story from Tony Lip, and we had tons of audio tapes and the letters that are in the movie. There were actually like 60-something letters. I thought there were 117 before last night. I was corrected. But this trip actually took place over a year. And, you know, it's a true story, but we covered the first 2 months that stopped at Christmas. But we borrowed from the entire journey.
Got it.
Things
okay.
that happened. And we had his perspective, Tony Lip telling us this story. And to tell it the other way would have felt to us inauthentic, because we really weren't in the head of Don Shirley. We did have audio tapes of his that we found later from other people who had taped him while making a documentary called Lost Bohemia about the people who lived above Carnegie Hall. And in it, he's talking about this trip, by the way, and Tony Lip. It was fantastic. But we had way more audio tape of Tony Lip telling specific stories. We also had to write the dialogue that connected all these things, because we didn't have that. So that's like people say, how true is it? Well, this stuff happened, but obviously we took a lot of license in how we arranged it and told the story.
You know, the great woke debate that's currently happening, and I think I would say filmmakers in my generation, we have to engage in it, because the stories that we're telling are about, you know, typically characters, whether they're black or gay or whatever, that, you know, typically don't get to be the protagonists in movies. And the question when you come to something like this is, okay, we, you know, I think people feel like it's a choice. It's like we want to show, you know, this otherworldly character from a more grounded white perspective so that audiences can sort of understand them. I interpret it a bit differently for this film, because I felt like Don Shirley is such a bizarre, charismatic. I mean, the way you talk about him is so interesting. He cultivated his own mystery. I mean, this is a celebrity in every respect. It's a person who, when you meet him or see him, you're meant to go, oh my God, who is that? And why is he so fancy? And
he sat
why does
on
he
a
talk
throne.
Like that? Yeah, he literally sits on a throne. Yeah. And so I thought it was to the movie's great advantage to meet him through Tony Lip, because one, we get to meet him the way an average person would meet him and sort of be blown away by the little things about him. And then also because, you know, presumably like you're some white guys, you should tell the story from a point of view that you're comfortable with, as opposed to sort of worry about getting it right, you
know?
Also,
Tony Lip's son, Nick Vallelonga, was one of the writers, and
so
he had
that's
so,
a
much,
nice connection.
So much information. But by the way, we did debate this. We thought, wait a second, are we telling it from the right side? And ultimately, this felt like the the natural, organic way to tell it. That's the side we had heard it from.
Mm-hmm.
So to go the other way would have been, you know, more difficult, and we would have had to, you know, make up more stuff.
Right, yeah. And I don't know. I think that's to the movie's advantage. Of course, like, people go back and forth on this. Like, I think they gave Coppola, who did The Beguiled.
Oh,
yes,
yeah,
The Beguiled. Yeah. There was such a big controversy over cutting out the slave character, and her sort of explanation was not received well. But I got it, because she was like, I don't know anything about that, and I don't want to fuck it up. It was more or less what she said. And I'm glad she didn't, because I've seen the other side, where in a movie about the past, about black people, the white writer will try to write the black person so noble and so tragically without any sense of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't do anything for me. You know what I mean? Like, to feel like all of your white guilt coming through in this character. I didn't feel that at all through Dr. Shirley in this script, because the minute we meet him, he is flawed.
Mm-hmm.
He is reading Tony the Riot Act. He doesn't like his shoes. He doesn't like the way he talks. He doesn't like the way he drives, you know, and immediately is in Mahershala's, you know, hands, is a fully formed person. How much of that was a part of the discussion with Mahershala or on set or about the character, just making sure he comes off real?
Yeah, well, Mahershala had a huge input on everything in this script, as did Vigo. They both did. You know, I'm a collaborative guy, and I would, you know, we went line by line through everything, and Mahershala was, you know, he was always correcting me and us about things. And I'll give you the example I always give, but there were 10 of these, is when they finally make, you know, become friends after the YMCA scene, when Doc Shirley realizes that, when he realizes that Tony Lip's a little more dimensional than he thought he was.
Yeah.
He thought he was a one-note kind of like Dem Dees and Dozer, but he's actually open-minded about certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And they become friends, and they're having a drink in the lobby, and Dr. Shirley's explaining that he was trained to be to classical music, but the record company said nobody will accept a black man as a classical musician.
Mm-hmm.
So he went on to do the music he does, which is a more poppy kind of different thing.
He's got like pop melodies in it.
Yeah, he arranged, you know, something he really created
American
himself.
American songbook stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and at that point, you know, Tony, he said he was trained to do this, and Tony Lip says, what do you mean trained? He goes, what are you, a SEAL? Anybody could be trained. He goes, but what you do, nobody could do.
Uh-huh.
And personally, I like it better.
Yeah.
And Doc Shirley at that point had said, well, thanks, Tony, and that was the end of the scene, but Mahershala read it, said, no, what do you think I'm going to do? Because Tony Lip likes what I do, I'm going to just say, hey, it's a good thing I didn't do my classical music.
Yeah.
Because this is bullshit. I would never. I would say, and so I said, great, perfect. So what do you say? So he says, well, thank you, Tony. He says, but not everybody can play Chopin. Not the way I can.
That line was brilliant. Also, there's a scene between the two characters in the rain where Mahershala hit me where I live. I'm going to butcher the line, and it's much better in the film, but it's something to the effect of like, well, I'm too black for these people.
Yeah.
You know, referring to the racist white cops and the people that hire him. But I'm not black enough for these people. And this is like, you know, this is the black everyman, the folks who are jamming on Little Richard and like, you know, into quote unquote black music. And he says, so where do I belong? And it is just this beautiful moment that I have felt so many times in my life, that so many of my characters have felt. It's always great for me as a black queerman to find out about other, you know, black men who did not live a traditional, quote unquote, black male life to connect with, because these figures are usually, you know, hidden from us, sadly.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, they've always been there, but that you couldn't admit who you were, and so it was hard to be who he was. In fact, to his death, he never really came out,
right,
and had been married, as many gay men back then did, you know,
and just, some today.
I
didn't want to, you know, I was kind of tiptoeing around it, because the reveal of his sexuality is quite great in the film, and that's all I'll say on it. I'll switch a page back to you, Chris. You know, speaking of a black man doing classical and pop music, you know, talk to me a little bit about when you got invited to the party. In terms of doing the music for it, how much of it is Don? How much of it is you? How much did encountering Don's life affect you as a musician?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, first of all, like the scene you're talking about, I feel like I've I mean, a lot of us have, but I've had those conversations myself. And so mm-hmm. even like when I first got called to come in for it, they sent me the script and I was reading through it. And there were so many things where I've had conversations with like white people that are telling me I'm not as black as they are because they listen to, you know, popular music. And especially when I was younger, when I was in high school, I only listened to like jazz and classical music. I didn't really listen to anything that was like current or anything like that. As far as like the music in the film, whenever Don Shirley's playing piano, that's all the original stuff. And we had to like go back and transcribe the original recordings because there's no sheet music for any of that stuff and re-record all of it so that we can have, the idea was to try to make it a little bit more, I guess, palatable for a modern day audience, but still respect the musicianship that he had, because we didn't want to dumb down what he was doing just so that people today could like listen to it and get it. And so with that, we just got a little bit more creative with how he mixed it and making it sound like it was a present day recording, but still all of the notes and even like all of the parts, the arrangements, all of those are the original Don Shirley things that sometimes we kind of arranged to make it make more sense within the context of the film, like shortening something or something like that. But other than that, all of that music is all his. And then the score is all inspired by that in different ways.
Okay. The score is, you can't underestimate what that score does for this movie. Because I've seen it without that score. And it, when he laid the score in, and I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not good at. Like, I don't tell wardrobe what to get Don Shirley. You know, I tell them, you know, that's, you know, Betsy Hyman. I said, just do your thing because she's great. And she comes up with all those things. And I didn't know what this score should be. But I trusted him, and I just said, just go do something. And he came back, and I just remember getting the first tingle up my back, like, oh, wow, this movie, all of a sudden it popped for me, the entire movie, when you laid the score in.
Oh, I appreciate that.
I have had that experience with Chris Bowers as well. He's a genius. It's fine.
Yeah.
Nobody else hire him. I want him forever. what was he doing? You know, you talk about not wanting to change up what he was doing to dumb it down. So what makes his music, you know, so brilliant for the layman?
One of the first things that I heard is, I'm trying to think of a simple way to describe it, but one of the first pieces I've heard of his was his version of Lullaby of Birdland, which is a popular American songbook song, that a jazz standard that I've played a million times. And he does this piano intro that first starts off quoting, I think, some Debussy piece. He starts playing the melody, but then it becomes like a fugue, this Bach fugue, which is, you know, a style of writing or a style of song, but for him, he was improvising this stuff. He was improvising these classical forms, which is like incredibly difficult to do. And he was doing things where he was improvising with both hands at the same time, playing totally different ideas in each hand.
Wow.
And like everything that he was playing was incredibly pianistic and virtuosic, but on a classical level. I feel like there are a lot of pianists, jazz pianists, like of course like Art Tatum or Oscar Peterson, that are playing, but it's all jazz vocabulary and it's incredibly pianistic and their dexterity is amazing, but it's all jazz vocabulary. And for Don, it's all classical stuff. It still sounds classical even though he's playing this jazz stuff, which is pretty incredible.
Okay, we need to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go anywhere. The movie is named after The Green Book, which was a guide for black people traveling the Jim Crow South, telling you what hotels you could stay at and places that were friendly to the quote-unquote American Negro.
Yeah.
What was that title always there? Did that come out through some process of the storytelling?
Yeah, it just came through the story. Actually, we would listen over and over to Tony Lip's telling of the story just for little details and actual lines right out of there, you know, take things right out of it. But probably the third or fourth time I was going through it, he said, yeah, and then they, you know, the record company had given us the book where the blacks could stay, so we did that. I said, well, back that up. What's he saying? He goes, the record company gave us the book where the blacks could stay. I was like, what is that? And we Googled it, and up came the Negro Green Book, Motorist Green Book.
Wow.
And we were like, what the hell is this? And by the way, I had never heard of it. I couldn't find a white human being who had heard of it. Uh-huh. And I would say 90% of my black friends hadn't heard of it.
I knew of it. I don't know that I knew that it was called the Green Book.
In the last 3 years, it's kind of gotten into the zeitgeist. Yeah. It's one of those things. And it's not necessarily because of this movie.
I was just Googling. This is why people know. It's because of Lovecraft that people know about it. Lovecraft, which is a horror film. Uh-huh. Well, it's a horror book, actually, that sort of takes Lovecraftian horror elements but applies them to the Jim Crow South. And there's a book of monsters in that. And I think that has hit a popular culture. I think they're adapting it at HBO with Misha Green. So many of these things, like I was saying before, are chronically uncovered in this country. And it's so cool to find out about them in such a well-made movie. I mean, I think people are going to continue to ask you about this, and I'll try not to be annoying about it. But, you know, it's a departure, I think, in the minds of folks, because with your brother, you made some of the biggest comedy movies of all time, and out comes this very human, tender, small, kind of Americana story. Mm. What, you know, as a filmmaker, like, what's your first, like, step when you're starting to do your job as to, like, how do I tell this story? Like, what do you do first?
Well, like any story, the first thing, if it was a comedy or this, the first thing we always do is we work on who's the character, who mm-hmm. are these people, what's their problem, and why do we care about them? That's the first thing we do. If, like, honestly, any comedy, I think, who's the guy, and what is it about him that we like enough that we can hang all those jokes on him? That's how we start a comedy. Mm-hmm. This one, I had real characters, so it was really doing, like, making sure I got it right, but this wasn't a conscious effort to, you know, do something that's a departure from me. Yeah. This was just, I heard the story, it was 3 years ago, it was before the current shitstorm we're in now, by the way.
Yeah, sure, I don't know what you're referring to, but,
no. I just loved it, and I thought, this is a great story for today. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to do it, but it didn't feel like a departure, it just felt like the next thing for me. I knew it was a departure, but I wasn't making it because of that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like filmmakers, you know, especially, you know, where I'm at in my stage, you always, oh, can they do comedy? And oh, can they do drama? But I think when you actually are doing it, the thing that you know is that it doesn't matter. I mean, it's sort of the comedy or the drama is what comes out when you just treat the text properly. Like, it's not a, you know, there are certainly people who are better fits for different genres, but, you know, to me it made sense. Like, I get why you do this next.
Well, would see, like, okay, I don't want to, you know, blow your horn, but Dear White People, that had both.
Yeah.
That was very funny, and it had a very serious, you know, underbelly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was giggling at that a lot.
Good. Yes.
When I started, I was a novelist, actually. I wrote a couple novels before I got into screenwriting. And if you saw my earlier work, it's not that far from this, I will say. Mm.
Okay, that's really interesting. And now, Chris, like, the stuff that you'll turn in for Dear White People always blows me away. And I just wonder, like, how does it start for you? Do you, you know, watch the scene a bunch of times? Like, what's your blank page? Where are you starting from?
For me, I wanted to start by just watching the film a bunch of times and, like, trying to feel it and find the point that felt for me like the easiest entry point for the film. And for me, it's a scene where Don Shirley and Tony Lip they have some car trouble and they have to stop, and then they get out of the car and Don Shirley sees these field workers working, and just Mahershala's performance in that moment is so, like, heartbreaking, actually. So I really chose that section to start. And as I was thinking about how to approach the score for this film, and, you know, Peter and I talked about making it very different from the Don Shirley music and making sure that the two things didn't sound, they sounded very different, but at the same time could exist in the same world. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I ended up re-stumbling upon and being inspired by was this story that I learned in college about Dvorak. And he was brought to America to give lessons at these conservatories. These teachers asked if he could teach these American students how to properly compose in the European style, how to properly use the orchestra in that way. Mm-hmm. And the longer he spent here, the more he started to tell them, you really should be listening to the poor people of this country and the music that they're making. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that, you know, for them, people like Dvorak or even Stravinsky, they were using folk melodies for all of their music, or for a lot of their music. A lot of their symphonies and ballets are all like folk melodies that they've reinterpreted. And so I just started looking at a lot of, like, early folk music, Negro spirituals, a lot of, like, like slave songs or like hymns and things like that, especially because Don Shirley, a lot of his music is also heavily inspired by mm-hmm. by Negro spirituals and hymns and things like that. And funny enough, if you look at early blues music, country music, folk music, it's all pretty similar actually yeah. as far as like the melodies and like, and it's probably just because the people are coming from similar places and all of that. So I just started studying the way that those melodies are structured and just started writing themes and ideas that could, if I wanted to, have them exist just as like a simple like piano melody or a piano piece and to sound like it was like a folk song or a spiritual or something like that. And then I decided to orchestrate it in a way that would be inspired by a lot of the music of that Don himself was inspired by. So like composers like Ravel or Gershwin or Debussy mm-hmm, and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And so having this more
modern American
exactly, yeah.
classical composer.
So what he's saying is not a lot of thought went into
yeah,
it.
Yeah, he just kind of came up with some stuff. Yeah, that's what I heard too.
10 minutes.
Yeah, no, it just sounded like he just put some crap together. Yeah. No, it's great, Chris, right? It's really good. Now, the thing that, I mean, people are going to be talking about a lot of things about the movie, but I think the performances are one of the standouts. I mean, Viggo and Mahershala are so good together. I mean, it's you're seeing these two guys fall in a kind of platonic love. I mean, it's like it's a kiss away from being the bodyguard. And it's so delightful to see this, you know, scrappy dude from, you know, the Bronx, you know, getting along with Don Shirley, you know, elegant, soft-spoken Don Shirley.
To see him soften opens my heart.
Oh my God, it's so heartwarming. See, you know,
my hardest part of making the movie, the scene that was most disturbing for me was dropping the glasses in the trash. And by the way, I kind of laugh at this now, but the first screening we did, I remember thinking, every black person is about to get up and leave as soon as this happens. I just had this fear. He drop it in. People say, oh, fuck this. I'm out of here. Why do I have to watch this?
Yeah.
You know, I always expect like half the audience to get up. And then afterwards, you know, they didn't get up. And afterwards, actually, we had a little Q&A and I asked, you know, I said, hey, you know, when that those glasses went into the trash, I asked the black audience members, what'd you think? And they said, I was happy. Because it's the truth.
Because it's the truth.
For sure. Yeah.
How do you decide what of Tony's racism to show? Because, I mean, the thing that I thought was so interesting about it is that Tony Lip's racism is it's like a social racism. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't really even need to he doesn't go through this journey to not be racist on the other side, although I do feel like that happened. But it's like the minute he meets Don, all of that seems to go away. And that's a very... I love that about the film because that is kind of how racism actually works. You know, people don't tend to sit around, you know, people do, of course, as we know, some of them are in the White House, but most people don't sit around sort of like rubbing their hands together thinking, how can I torture black people? Like they don't obsess over that aspect of themselves. It just is, you know. How did you guys make that decision? What goes in and what goes out?
It was easy to do because in his audio tapes, he was that way. Mm-hmm. And yet he was also a beautiful, loving guy.
Yes.
It was really interesting. Like, he would drop N-bombs, but he wouldn't say that N-bomb. He would say...
He would use it the way...
We would walk into a room, and I could see all the people look at him, and they didn't like N-bombs. He would say it that way.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Highly problematic person. I love it.
No, so it's a complicated guy.
Yeah.
And also, like, I saw it as, like, it was a northern racism. And that's how people were.
It is a northern racism.
It was a northern racism where, you know, you had this kind of way of looking, but it wasn't a systemic racism like in the South.
It wasn't like, I don't want them to live. It's just I would rather they not drink from my glass.
Well, there weren't
which
laws
is still
about
fucked
it.
Up.
Like in the South, there were laws. You can't drink out of that thing, you can't try on a suit.
Yes,
you know, because if you don't buy it, no one else is going to want to wear it. That's their thinking.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now you as a director, you know, you got Viggo Mortensen on your right, you got Mahershala Ali on your left. Like, what's your role on that set? What is your responsibility to the act?
Well, I usually stay home, drink,
come
in
I
at
would.
The end of the day.
Yeah, that's what
and
I do.
See
too.
What they did.
Yeah,
normally this is what I think of when I have a script. You're hoping that the actors can bring it to the level that you believe that script can be.
Yes.
And if you have good actors, they can do that. But if you have great actors like these guys, it's way better.
Yeah.
Like, this movie is so much better than on the page, and it was good on the page.
Yeah.
It was, people loved this script, you know, but their performances are so nuanced, and it's the reactions, mm-hmm. and it's the it's what Mahershala Ali does without doing anything. It's all an inner show.
He's incredible.
Him. It's unbelievable what he does with just the slightest little head turn. Mm-hmm. He has his moments here and there, but it's mostly an inner performance where everything he's doing is playing off Vigo's big performance,
right.
And it's these tiny little things that are making it hilarious. Because yes. on the paper,
oh,
you know,
so
it wasn't
shady.
That funny, but you're giggling at his reaction. Like, oh my God.
Mahershala in this is the king of shade and reading. I mean, all the gay terms. Like, he is so fierce in the movie. I think what's really hard about when a straight guy plays, you know, gay, is that gay men, we have different, we have modulations of our gay expression genes, just to say it in a very technical way. You know, like,
did you make that up, or is that
there is an actual gene that is separate from your actual sexuality. Oh, yeah. To do with your expression.
No, I didn't mean the
Isn't
gene.
This crazy?
I mean the actual, that expression.
Oh, what did I even say? I don't even know.
Modulate
our gay genes, yes. But, you know, it's a survival technique. But also just naturally, like, some gay guys don't present, you know, it's not a monolith, but it's very tricky to get that right. Because Don Shirley was just kind of on that line where you're like, oh, is he fancy? Is he foreign? Is he a dandy of some kind? Is he gay? Like, you're not quite sure. And Mahershala walks it with such humanity and such subtlety. And Vigo, of course, too, who is embodying a very different kind of persona. But I just... the character that Mahershala is playing is just so rare in cinema.
Yeah. Mm.
And he just really knocked it out of the park. Now, Chris, you know, I touched on this a little bit, but just Don Shirley as a person, like, how are you? Do you feel like you are a different composer because of this experience on this movie? How did this process change you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's kind of encouraged me to be even more demonstrative about my influences. Mm. You know, I think that, like, and I guess in an unafraid way, you know, I think that, like, whenever I'm making my own music, I'm always trying to figure out how to combine all these things that I'm really into and what things do I kind of, you know, lean on a little bit more. And a lot of that has to do with what I think other people might be into and what other people might like. And listening to his music and working on it really just inspired me to not really care what anybody else thinks about the music that I'm doing, just kind of combine the things that I want to combine
really?
In the way that I want.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, for
wow.
sure.
What kinds of things would normally scare you? I'm just curious about, like, what
I guess know. Just because, like, one of the things is that
people aren't ready for this jazz blues combo I'm doing. Like,
combining a lot of the classical influences, for example, and, like, being fearful that my music is then not black enough, you know, or doesn't mm-hmm. like feel like it has that soul enough, or like adding some things that, you know, are a little bit more typical in, like, black music, and then feeling like the other people might not feel like it's, you know, impressive enough or pianistic enough, you know, all these
right.
different things that, like, I was trying to make sure that I was impressing everybody, making sure that, like, the people that are going to look at it for theoretical reasons would be impressed, and the people that are just going to, like, bump in their car are going to be impressed.
Right,
and
right.
Now I just kind of just want to make the music that I want to make and see who likes it. Yeah.
Well, good for you.
You know, one thing we haven't talked about is him actually playing. We haven't talked too much about this, him playing in the movie.
For sure.
Well, I'm going to let y'all talk about that.
No, which is
I'm not giving away no movie secrets
no,
now.
No,
I'm
I appreciate
a part of the guild now.
Yeah. No, you don't want to, you know, magicians don't come out before the show
right.
and explain the tricks they're going to do. So,
right.
But I have to say, like, there when he does that Chopin in the bar, you know,
yeah.
it is like we have, like, you know, I don't know how many extras there. What would you say? 100? I'd say 1,000.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
and these people, everybody was like, oh my God, it was a trip. Just
wow.
sitting there watching him play everywhere we went, you know. And again, Mahershala did, they did work together. Mahershala, you know, he did start and do some stuff and he learned a lot. But obviously, when you got down to the meat and potatoes,
tickling the ivories,
the real stuff,
you bring in Chris.
And it was just like a, you know, it was just such a great moment when you could bring him in and just, you know, you've been working your butt off all day.
I mean,
like,
the piano playing in particular is pretty exciting. I mean, that sounds so crazy to say, but the fingers to play these pieces are, I mean, you're, I, I don't even know how you do that. Like, forget actually just hitting the correct keys. Just moving your fingers in that rhythm, coordinated.
No mistakes. Like, yeah. I don't ever remember one take where he's like halfway through. Oh, shoot, shit, fuck, let me start over. That never happened. It was always like, you look at us like, it's perfect.
Yeah.
It was just crazy.
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to talk about Mahershala's playing piano and how when we did a few months of lessons together, and it was just incredible to watch how dedicated he was to try to do that to the best of his ability. And like our first lesson, we were supposed to spend an hour together, and I figured we'd just play like a major scale, and he spent 3 hours playing this one scale over and over again, and I would have to like physically stop him to like, because I would like say, oh, you know, we can move on, and he would just keep playing it over and over again. And that's just how he was like on set, and you know, he was just incredibly driven and dedicated to like to represent a pianist in the right way, and it really shows in the film. I think that like I've watched so many movies where you see somebody that is playing piano that even just the way they sit at the piano, I'm like, oh, he's not a pianist. Yeah. And he does an incredible
job.
That's
not pianistic enough.
Like, that wasn't luck. He really thought about those things. Yeah, that's why he's Mahershala Ali.
Yeah.
Seriously. He said, look, Pete, and he talks about this. He says, if I'm in the subway and I see a dancer walk by, I could tell she's a dancer by the way she walks. And I want somebody to look at me and know the way that's I sit pianist, at that piano, I'm a pianist.
It is pianistic, frankly.
Yes. Yeah.
So I have a thing called Culture Community. It's a group on Facebook. If you are following me on Facebook, you can join. But it's a lot of up-and-coming creatives, and I sometimes will give them a slot to ask a question. This is one that's coming from Travis Baker. He says, I'd love to hear a discussion over films depicting racism of the past versus racism of the present. Driving Miss Daisy versus Do the Right Thing. Do such films of the past paint a narrative that such issues are behind us, or is it possible for them to remind us of the issues facing us in the present? Peter?
Well, first of all, I don't pretend to be an expert on all things race, but you know, I'm not a historian on filmic racism either. I wish, by the way, I wish that I could play this movie and when it ended, people said, "Oh my God, really? It was like that back then?
There was racism at a
You're
certain
kidding
point
me.
In time?
And that's only 50 years ago, and there was racism. Yeah, they had it back in the 60s. Believe it or not.
That reaction would be amazing such a thing were possible.
That would be my dream, but it's not that way. In fact, people, you know, they see it as a reminder of what's happening today. And it's also but the thing that they're drawn to is that today we're going apart. Mm-hmm. We're really going apart. We're, you know, nothing goes like, you know, improvement doesn't go like straight up the chart.
It's not
it
a
goes
straight
like
line.
This. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It goes up and down. And there are improvements and then there's downturns. We're in a downturn. And people are recognizing it. But the worst part is that people are growing apart. And this movie is about two guys who couldn't be more different. You have a racist bouncer. Italian-American bouncer with a sixth-grade education who I always say didn't pay much attention after third grade.
Yeah.
And you have a black concert pianist with several doctorates who speaks many languages and is a total sophisticate. Mm-hmm. And yet, by the end of this trip of being in a car together for this couple months, they grow closer together and they realize they have a lot in common.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm hoping people get out of it. Certainly not that those days are gone. Those days aren't gone.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But what can happen is what happened in that thing if we open to each other. There are walls. Everybody has more walls up. And
what I loved about it is it showed you, if nothing else, that it's just possible. I mean, I think that when you get to see yourself in someone that doesn't look like you, it really is in the real world and in this film, it is a kind of experience that almost feels like a miracle.
That's one reason people are so surprised, because when you go into a movie that's quote unquote about race, you're expecting to have to go through a painful journey, and it is a painful journey, but you come out of it feeling good.
Oh yeah, it's really warm and fuzzy. I mean, because I also don't think I don't think the movie's about race. I think it's about these two men.
Yeah.
It's about seeing yourself in somebody that you don't think you'd ever see yourself in. I mean, that's really what it's about. It's in the backdrop of race. But I'll tell you a couple of things that, you know, movies like this usually make black people roll their eyes that your movie does not do. the black character in it has a sense of agency. He mm-hmm. hires Tony. He calls for Tony. He sends for Tony. And the choices that he makes are not because Tony saves him or, you know, I mean, he physically saves his life yeah, a few times.
That's what he's hired to do.
Yeah, but he's, you know, the moves that, like, we're on this tour because Dr. Shirley said, you know what? They don't think a black guy can do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm going to, you know, so he actually is pushing the narrative. The other thing that I felt like, you know, these movies do that this movie didn't do was that there isn't a, it isn't a movie about a black person getting saved when whiteness happens. Like, it is not about that. It is these two people in a scenario that, yeah, he hired this guy to physically protect him. But, you know, Don was Don before Tony Lip, and he's Don after. And I just really appreciated that. Well, this is, I love conversations with fellow creatives. Thank you so much, Peter Fairley, being here to talk about your movie Green Book. Thank you, Chris Bowers, here to talk about being the composer for Green Book. And, you know, hopefully you'll come back and talk to me about something else. But this has been a real pleasure.
Better
Thank ball. You so
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Justin. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys. Okay, I got to thank my amazing guests, Peter Fairley and Chris Bowers, for sitting down with me today. Also want to thank our producers, Gina Delvac and Kara Hart, our production engineers, Daniel Balistocki and Chuck Privateri. Special thanks to Vishnu Vallabhaneni, head of programming, Quinn O'Toole. Chris Bowers was our guest, and he created our theme song, What Can't He Do? This is Don't At Me with Justin Simeon. If you like the show, please subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a review. Despite the name of the show, I actually want to hear from you. We'll be back next week in another episode of Don't At Me from the one and only KCRW. We'll be here too.